And so that was the background of it. Dean Gildersleeve and I had quite a lot of discussions, different subjects, because in effect we were the two that were not in a public office at that particular moment. She was in education, and I had been in state government, was then out. So we had a little different viewpoint sometimes, a little different perspective, especially in human rights and in the preamble. We did quite a bit of work on the preamble.
I think she considered that you were the only one on the delegation who was really interested in that preamble. The others, she said, didn't seem to care.
Well, I wouldn't say that of the others, but it sometimes, too, was a matter of, as I said, we divided up the prime responsibilities, and like in the matter of the, you know, the regional approach, and the, see, there had been a Latin American conference at Chapultepec.
Yes.
And how this region, South American and how the countries of this area would relate to the World Organization and what effect it would have, had a lot of tensions in it, a lot of uncertainties and a lot of different views.
Mm-hmm.
So there would be times when some delegates would be so caught up in that they wouldn't give much attention to, and that was partly also a matter of reciprocal confidence. That is, I think, on the preamble, they would discuss it in our delegation meetings, but they would feel that Dean Gildersleeve would do an able job there, and she did tend to turn to me to help explain to the delegation or to try to help work out some other language. We did quite a bit of work on that together.
Yes, from that original that was prepared by General Smuts, which was so very stiff.
That's right.
And certainly the preamble has turned out to be a very beautiful, I think, today. It's so often read at the conferences.
I was going to say it's probably quoted more than any other part of the Charter, isn't
it? Yes,
yes. It, that's one of the interesting things, of course, where some view is, well, after all, you know, that is not a part of the actual, you might say, biting force of the document, but yet psychologically it has tremendous significance. And
we often get famous actors to read the preamble at the United Nations concert each year.
Oh, do you? Yeah.
It comes over very well, I think.
Mm-hmm.
How difficult was it to come to a unanimous position on the various issues within the delegation? Because I think you had this wonderful freedom to put your own views, but then I understand that you would come to a unanimous decision on most issues.
Mm-hmm.
Did this take sometimes a long...
Well, now one of the things from the studies of the, you know, the Dumbarton Oaks and the whole situation, and then the effects of Security Council action and the veto in the Security Council, I was concerned as to the matter of self-defense in a circumstance if the Security Council was not acting, and what effect that might have. So I originated the suggestion of that there be some kind of a section about nothing in the Charter shall impair the inherent right of self-defense if an armed attack occurs. And that was at first pretty much rejected. Of course, there was a general sort of a mindset of those who had worked on the original Dumbarton Oaks draft, and that had gone to that of objecting to any change in it, especially in the early stages. But I think it soon became apparent that it needed changing. And in that instance, we did at one stage reach the situation that I was in effect told that in a discussion, not in a rough way, but it was very clear, well, if since I was the only one that had put that forward, and no one else had joined in it, why shouldn't I just withdraw it? And I felt it was so fundamental that there was a stage in which I said, well, if Charter doesn't have something like this in, and if you all want to go ahead, then I think the right thing for me to do is withdraw from the delegation and say why. And then they said, well, that wouldn't do. Well, I said, well, you've been resisting the necessity for this, but suppose we turn it and you each tell why you do not want to see it in the charter. And then as that kind of discussion started, actually, I believe on that subject, Dean Gildersleeve was the first one then to join me in saying this ought to be in. And then, as I remember, it was Congressman Eaton. But they finally came around, and as you know, it's in the charter, and that literally started with a memorandum that I circulated to our United States delegation. Then after they agreed it ought to be in there, then brought it up in the five power meetings and talked it over, and it finally stayed in. But what is it, Article 54 now? I think it is. I'm not sure. But it's that see, the problem that was thought of there is that if a Security Council action was vetoed and an armed attack was going on, that unless you had an affirmative, and you're supposed to, you know, not use your own military force, you in effect would have to be violating the charter in order to defend yourself, and we didn't want that. And that, of course, that individual collective self-defense has turned out to be a very important principle, even though at times it's still controversial. So I do have a fair amount of responsibility in that area as to what finally happened on the long term of history of the provision for inherent right of individual and collective self-defense. Mm-hmm. You find that was not in the original Dumbarton Oaks and so forth, but came in at San Francisco. Another one, of course, was the matter of a manner of calling a conference to revise the charter.
Oh, yes.
That's another place where we brought it up. Mm-hmm. And that's an interesting subject because that wasn't in there at first. And we, this has a very strong meaning, and maybe we can get into it more, that many of us who were working on that charter felt that for many reasons there were limits to what you could accomplish in getting that charter and getting agreement and getting started. But we felt, and many discussed it, that in 10 or 15 years, it really ought to be rewritten. That is, we really ought to have a new charter. And so that gave rise then to making it, in effect, easier to take a move for a new charter. I think it was after the 10th year, something of that kind. Mm-hmm. And there was some resistance to that in the, and when we discussed it in the Big Five meeting, I pointed out that so many of the men of all these countries were then off in the war, and this charter was being drafted, and a few of us had been called back to take part of it from the war, but that literally you couldn't predict how the world would be And there was just this, the latter part there, the beginnings of the outlook of a changing world picture, rumors of new types of weapons, and that all of those who were out in the war would feel they hadn't been participating in their governments. There ought to be a chance to rewrite the charter. And that finally, the sentiments swung through in that article. I don't remember now, is that 109 or something
yes,
like that?
Yes, 109, yes.
Mm-hmm. Now, it's one of my current feelings is that all of the countries have kind of drifted since that time, and that it is urgent to really bring the charter up to date, and that it does need rewriting. And it's a big task. It takes years to really bring through another agreement on it. But I do think that that is a part of, I spoke of the fact that many were saying there would be a third world war. Anyhow, in 15 or 20 years, we're wasting our time. Well, here we are, 38 years later, and while there have been many rough moments, there hasn't been a world war. And to have the charter do its job for the next 35 years, I think we do need to bring it up to date. It's a big subject.
Mm-hmm. Why don't you ask him right now, while he's on the point, how he would like to bring it up to date? What points he thinks?
Oh, okay. I thought we wanted to keep it.
Mm-hmm.
So, thinking that the charter needs to be up to date, do you have some specific ideas that you would propose?
Well, I do have quite a few, but whether we ought to shift over to that right now, I'm not certain whether we should stay back on the original.
We were thinking of going into it later, I think.
All right. So,
mm-hmm. I'd like to get back to personalities a little bit. I was thinking of Ambassador Gromyko. It seems mm-hmm. to me that you had a number of discussions. I don't know whether they would have been altercations, but a number of discussions with him, and I wonder whether you recall some of them.
Well, we did, as you say, had many, many working relationships through the years. A very able person, and very clearly endeavoring to represent his country and his government's views. You know, I always found that the most important thing was to try to think through where he was coming from. I mean that in the sense of trying to analyze what would be their objectives, their fears, their concerns, and their aims, and then try to evaluate those in relationship to what should be done. But I guess he is one of the few who were active then that's still very active.
Mm-hmm.
Just right now is, I guess, the deputy in the country.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. How would you assess the general functioning of that conference? Do you think it went pretty smoothly, all in all?
Not smoothly,
no.
At all, but the fact of reaching an agreement, I think, was quite a thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I do think that the fact that about halfway through, particularly Senator Vandenberg and I and a number of other delegates here and there, tried to face up to the question, what needed to be the minimum charter that was worthwhile to put together? I mean, on what basis would we end the war with an organization in being? Or at what point would it be better to say we have failed to establish an organization and then see what would happen subsequently when the wars were all over? Whether we could then make a start, or whether there'd be some other forms of intergovernmental consultations or something that would go on. And that that ultimate question was thought through and discussed through about halfway through the conference. And I think it cleared a lot as to, you know, when was there an issue that it should be made very clear that this was one that just had to be resolved. Because if we couldn't resolve certain issues, it would be better that we don't act like they've been resolved. And obviously, with the passage of time, our judgments can be subject to review and to, as we call it, post-game quarterbacking. But we tried to think of it that way. What kind of a charter would be worthwhile to go ahead on, and if we couldn't do certain things, what would it be better? And one of those, of course, was the decision that there had to be something on the trusteeship portion. That is, we couldn't really feel we had an organization that could survive if it was completely silent on the whole big question of all of these mandated territories and all of these colonies. And the other one of the others was the veto. Then, of course, the matter of UN armed forces, which has had a kind of a checkered history with these national forces devoted to United Nations objectives and performed some good functions, but obviously no real United Nations force itself has been established. The ins and outs of that one. So there's a lot of those sections that, you know, academically people might, or as I say, in looking back, advantage of hindsight, might say, well, why don't you do this or that? But we had a real sense at the time of trying to put together as good a beginning as could be put together with certain minimum standards that, unless it could be have its own survivability and own functional qualities, that it would be better not to make a beginning. Mm-hmm. We faced up to that issue.
You mentioned earlier on that you did quite a bit of the press relations business that you mm-hmm. were responsible, I think. I think you coordinated, didn't you, any statements made by the delegation to the press?
Not really coordinated, but they officially made a decision. I don't even know whether it shows in minutes and so on, but there was a time
yes.
when the delegation, at a delegation meeting, there had been various indications, well, there's been this story and that story and another story that had, you might say, either inaccuracies or limited accuracy and so on, and the delegation said, reached the conclusion together that it's better to tell the press what's happening regularly than leaving them just pick it up here and there. And that was when they decided that they wanted me to do it. And then they reviewed it a few times as to how I was doing it.
Well, the press had quite a problem, didn't they? I mean, yes. they weren't allowed to go into the committee meetings.
No, there was no, that's it. No,
so
none
they
of the
really
session.
Had quite
only
a
the plenaries were open to the media.
And
so it was all a matter of, so the real work was just that they had to pick it up here and
yes.
there.
Yes.
So that, and that was, it was a kind of a, it wasn't an easy problem either to decide just how to brief them. But I did, I think I established these rules, and I don't remember how clearly they came through to the delegation, but we discussed quite a bit that time. It was fairly early when we decided we had to brief the media, and they asked me to do it. And I said that I'm never going to give them any false information. I refuse to ever do that. But I will at times tell them that it's not yet the time to discuss that issue, that it's true there is such an issue, and we are working on it, but it's not yet the time to tell you what our, the United States delegation feels is going to happen to it or what their position is on it.
I think the American delegates at most conferences, and I expect it was the same here, are usually much more forthcoming than a lot of the other delegates who tend to hold back, seem to think there's some danger in speaking to the media, and often miss possibilities to get across to the public a particular point.
Well, and of course, the media also being completely free, you get many different kinds of results, too. I remember if we discussed that, you know, the fact that you brief them doesn't necessarily mean you're going to be happy with the story.
I remember you gave a press conference right at the fairly near the beginning where you outlined the nine U.S. objectives. I think that went over quite well for what the delegation, what the United States hoped to get out of the conference. I suppose the media tended to hang around the Big Four and Big Five meetings, and that sometimes the information would leak out of these meetings, get to the floor of the committees. Did such leaks ever cause embarrassment to the United States?
Both embarrassment and humor.
Well, that's nice. Tell us about some of them.
I remember one of the really uproarious times, and I can't right remember what maybe it was. A delegate got up, it seems to me it was from one of the South American countries. He said, "I see in our minutes that at our meeting last week, we did ABC. But I read in the New York Times that what we did was X, Y, and Z. Now what did we do?" And of course the crowd, the whole meeting just broke up in uproarious laughter, because it wasn't a deeply serious issue, but he happened to find an instance in which, and the upshot of it was, I think that the decision was made that neither was accurate, neither the minutes nor the New York Times, that actually that the whole subject was still open or something or other. That was in one of those sessions. Seemed to me it was something about the assembly, and you know, there was the matter of what was domestic and what was a proper activity for the United Nations was another one of these issues that took a lot of negotiating and a lot of different views, and that language that finally evolved about within the scope of the charter, which was the solution that emerged out of that, was an interesting sequence. But no matter whether simply by declaring something domestic that you could close off the United Nations from having anything to say about it, or just how that and then how the veto might affect that and so on, there was quite a bit of negotiating and controversy over that part of the language.
What about, you said they were both humorous and times of where the media could be an embarrassment. Do you recall any particular time when a story hit the New York Times, for instance?
Well, there were times, I can't remember the exact circumstances, in fact maybe just as well that I don't try to recite it, but there'd be times when, you know, one of the media stories would, in effect, say that the delegate from a certain country took a certain position, and his government or her government would cable and say, "What are you doing? This is not the position." See,
yes.
And the matter of sometimes they, and some of this happened in trusteeship, where if there was a media report that a delegate of a country had taken a certain position on a trusteeship issue and had not in fact taken that position, but it caused embarrassment in their home governments, because there were, as I said, it's a kind of a subject where within governments there were different views. you know, between Defense Department and State Department, or both of them, and if they had a colonial department and so forth. But there were times when they would come to me to verify to their government that they had not said the thing that was in the story.
You must have to give a signed statement.
to actually confirm that, that I was in that meeting, and of course by that time they all knew I was taking the leading role in working out the trusteeship chapter. And sometimes it would be that a certain language of a certain part of the document still had to be resolved, that it had not been agreed or something like that. But there were those kind of circumstances.
Governor Stassen, you seem to have had such a multifaceted role at the conference. In fact, I hope that later today we're going to talk more about international peace and security, Security Council, and evaluation, etc. But if I could put you a personal question, how did you view yourself, your role at San Francisco? Did you sort of consider that it was more representational, requiring a great deal of diplomacy, than technical, or a mixture of both?
I really viewed it as, you might say, this may seem to be a as basically being a member of the human race on this earth. In other words, that you could not correctly try to put a national objective above the objective of all humanity. That needs definition and so forth. But you see, the background, as I mentioned, that I had been advocating that there needed to be an organization somewhat of this nature, and had gone into quite a bit of detail of it years before the first call for United Nations in speeches and articles. And that, in turn, sprang out of the fact that as a college student, I had decided that in my lifetime I wanted to make a contribution toward world peace. And as I described earlier, I had felt that when the war broke out, that I needed to, and that is, that the right thing for me to do was, as a young naval reserve officer, go on duty. And yet I thought in terms that pulled me away from my life objective, but then President Roosevelt's action pulled me back into this, so that I felt that I rightly needed to be alert to the responsibilities of representing the security of my own country and of the interests of my country, but that you really could not fulfill the requirements of getting an organization like this going if you put those as the priority concerns. Now that sometimes gave me some problems with those of a more conservative or traditional viewpoint. And it gives some problems in definition and implementation. But that really was the way I endeavored to operate.
I think you were one of the people I noticed who really thought very much about the interdependence of peoples. The need of one country for another. It's sometimes very difficult for Americans, for instance, to realize that what happens in a small country in Africa can have an effect on their own lives and the lives of their children and the economy of the country, for instance. And it seemed to me that you had thought out these things pretty
See,
far,
there's
far
a
ahead of the
time. Well, you have to have a further background there, too, in the sense that, you see, within our domestic political scene, I had been the floor manager for the nomination of Wendell Willkie in 1940, see, before the war ever started, before Pearl Harbor, in 1940. And he was one that enunciated very dramatically that this is one world. In fact, he at one stage wrote a book, This Is One, on One World, and that sense. And as I've sometimes put it, that, you know, in the modern world, and it's more true now by far than it was 35 years ago, that in these decades ahead, it'll not be a matter of winners or losers, but the matter of a common experience of all humanity on this earth. It's as basic as that. And to interpret that along with the responsibilities of the national sovereignties and the loyalties and patriotism to your own country is not easy, but that's where it rests.
I did notice in reading some of the records that when compliments were showered upon you for your patience and statesmanship in piloting the working paper through the trusteeship committee, that you were very quick to compliment the work of the members of the other delegations, your own advisors. I think it was rather a nice feeling. I remember you said once that they did the work, it fell to my lot simply to have the honor of standing up and making the motions.
Mm-hmm. Well, it was true, too. You see, no one can individually accomplish things. And actually, by my...